You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
If you ever visit Jerusalem, you'll likely visit a place that has been venerated as the location of both Jesus' death and resurrection, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Within the ancient walls of this huge church are the traditional sites of both Jesus' crucifixion and burial. It's a jumble of chapels and altars that represent centuries of posturing and bickering between Catholic and Orthodox interests, some turf wars resulting in fist fights and the calling of the police. In fact, the various Christian interests have been so obstinate for so long that during the Crusades, Saladin gave up on trying to negotiate which Christian sect should be the keepers of the keys. So Saladin gave it to a Muslim family for safekeeping. And every day for over 800 years, members of that Muslim family have been unlocking the sepulchre every morning and locking it every night. It was one of the highlights of my last trip to Jerusalem to take Maddie and Sam to the locking up ceremony and meet one member of the Yude family who have been keepers of the key for hundreds of years. But Protestants have always had sepulchre envy. So back in the 19th century, there was a push to identify another nearby location where Protestants could come on pilgrimage and contemplate the events of Good Friday and Easter. So today, just outside the Damascus Gate, you'll find the Garden Tomb, maintained as a pilgrimage site that offers an example of what first century tombs looked like. Note that it is hewn out of rock and has a track for the disc-shaped stone to be rolled over the door. Having a rolling stone was important because burial in those days was not what we practice today. At most, the body was in the tomb for a year or so to be reduced to bones. Then the bones would be removed and placed in an ossuary or bone box, and moved to another family location. That being said, you've essentially got two different sites vying for recognition as the place where Easter happened. And far from being problematic, it fits right in with all the other conflicts of Easter. Like the birth narratives, each gospel tells a different version of the events that first Easter. And counting Paul, there are really five explicit and very different accounts of Easter, none written by an eyewitness. Who saw what first? The number of angels at the tomb, Jesus' appearance, all vary from book to book. Mark has three visitors to the tomb. Matthew has two. John has only one. In Mark and Luke and John, a large stone has already been rolled away. In Matthew, an earthquake rolls it away. Hey, these stories were written 40, 50, 60 plus years after the fact. So you've got to allow for some artistic license, right? So I know you're tired of hearing me say it, but I encourage you to take some time and actually read some of these stories for yourself. I found it really helpful to read them all right next to one another, side by side. And you can do that at a site maintained by the University of Toronto. Look for a link in the notes below called Gospel Parallels. Each gospel has its own version of Easter and tells the story in a way that furthers that particular author's agenda. And remember, when you're reading, know that the difference between what really happened and what the gospel writers have written is akin to the difference between real war and a John Wayne movie. Check them out for yourself. Keep in mind the context and soak up the richness of their varying visions of Easter Sunday. In today's reading, John begins by placing a grieving Mary Magdalene at the tomb even before daylight has returned. As much as for their being frozen by fear as for the religious conventions of Judaism, none of the male disciples have been to the tomb yet. People will often ask me how scholars place the Gospels in different time periods and cultures, and you can actually hear a clear example in our passage today. Note that John has Mary call Jesus Rabboni, which is then quickly translated from Hebrew. This is clear evidence, along with a lot of other material in John, that John's readers aren't Jewish and are, in fact, pretty far removed from the culture in which the original disciples lived. So, let's hear an excerpt from John's version of Easter, keeping in mind the tension between John probably being the least historically accurate gospel, while at the same time being one of the most beloved versions, especially because of stories just like this one, where we get characters that we can relate to as human beings, experiencing the whole gamut of human emotions.
Our words of wisdom are from John chapter 20, verses 1 through 18. Early in the morning on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and saw that the stone was moved away from the entrance. She ran at once to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, breathlessly panting.
"They took the master from the tomb. We don't know where they've put him."
Peter and the other disciple left immediately for the tomb. They ran neck and neck. The other disciple got to the tomb first, outrunning Peter. Stooping to look in, he saw the pieces of linen cloth lying there, but he didn't go in. Simon Peter arrived after him, entering the tomb, observed the linen cloth lying there, and the kerchief used to cover his head, not lying with the linen cloth, but separate, neatly folded by itself. Then the other disciple, the one who had gotten there first, went into the tomb, took one look at the evidence, and believed. No one yet knew from the scripture that he had to rise from the dead. The disciples then went back home.
But Mary stood outside the tomb, weeping. As she wept, she knelt to look into the tomb and saw two angels sitting there, dressed in white, one at the head, the other at the foot, where Jesus' body had been laid. They said to her,
"Women, why do you weep?"
"They took my master, and I don't know where they put him."
After she said this, she turned away and saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't recognize him. Jesus spoke to her, "Woman, why do you weep? Who are you looking for?" She, thinking that he was the gardener, said,
"Mister, if you took him, tell me where you put him so I can care for him."
Jesus said, "Mary."
Turning to face him, she said in Hebrew, "Rabboni," meaning teacher.
Jesus said, "Don't cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. Go to my brothers and tell them, I ascend to my Father and your Father, my God and your God."
Mary Magdalene went, telling the news to the disciples, "I saw the Master," and she told them everything he said to her.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
If your family is like mine, we cherish the places where we bury our dead. One of my earliest Easter memories is going to put flowers on the graves of relatives over at Greenwood Memory Lawn over in West Phoenix. Even before I understood what a cemetery was, I was taken along, and the solemnity of my parents and other relatives was not lost on me. We placed flowers and quiet words were spoken. So imagine my alarm when, a few months ago, Maddie, Sam, and I stopped at the cemetery and discovered that my grandma, Lori, was, well, gone. I knew where she was supposed to be, but she wasn't there. I went to the cemetery office and I asked if they knew what was going on, and they said, "We don't know." So, like any self-respecting grandson, I went home and got a shovel, right? I think in part because it seemed deliciously inappropriate to be taking a shovel to the cemetery. The kids were totally into it. We referred to some old photos to be sure, and bam, Maddie hit headstone on her first spadeful. It was like an archaeological dig. Maddie and Sam lovingly cleared away several inches of dirt and grass and gently cleaned off the stone. Suffice it to say, we were relieved to find Grandma Lori, my dad's birth mother, who was lost but was now found. It was because of her diagnosis of tuberculosis the Feltons ended up in Arizona in the first place, and I'm here with you today. And when I reread today's gospel scene in John, I immediately had a flashback to that moment of confusion, standing in the cemetery and thinking, wait, what? How is this possible? Where's my grandma? In our story today, Mary, too, is reeling from the reality of what's in front of her not matching her expectations. Wait, what? Where's Jesus? And after reporting to the other disciples, they survey the scene for themselves and leave distraught. A missing body just adds insult to injury. And here I think it's good to point out that the text says the other disciple is said to have looked into the tomb and believed. Many have suggested that he believed Jesus was alive. Woohoo! But his actions suggest that he simply believed Mary, that the body was gone. The next verse in John says that the disciples went home and locked the doors, hardly the action of those excited by the prospect of new life. So something had happened, but it wasn't clear what that something was. What difference would this make for their lives? They didn't know. Uncertain, afraid, and not sure how to respond, maybe it was best just to not do anything at all. Truth be told, I think a lot of Christians are still uncertain, afraid, and not sure what to do. And the broader church has been a willing collaborator in the resultant inaction. As we've discovered in Kurt Struckmeyer's book, A Conspiracy of Love, there are really two completely different gospels being practiced in the world today, the gospel about Jesus and the gospel of Jesus. And there's no better place to see the differences between these two gospels in action than at Easter. First off, the gospel about Jesus emphasizes a cosmic story of sin and forgiveness, the devil being defeated, God's bloodlust being satiated, and the supernatural power God has over the forces of nature. The gospel about Jesus also promotes the idea that the more earnest you are in believing in Jesus' literal, physical resurrection from the dead, the more God will love you. It's all about having a supernatural spectacle to which you can point as proof the promise of heaven. On the other hand, the gospel of Jesus acknowledges that Jesus was executed for promoting an agenda that threatened the oppressive and unjust status quo. The wealthy and the powerful did what they always do, eliminate the threat with extreme prejudice. After all, if you kill the leader, the movement usually dies. But after Jesus' death, the movement he created did not, in fact, evaporate. It continued to grow underground, behind the scenes, I don't know, like a conspiracy. So today, it's common to find those who follow the gospel of Jesus embracing the idea that Jesus was indeed resurrected, but metaphorically. Jesus was and is resurrected in the people who believe in his message of hope and justice and who follow his example in the world. Let me say that again. Jesus was and is resurrected in the people who believe in his message of hope and justice and who follow his example in the world. And no matter what the proponents of the gospel about Jesus claim, the resurrection accounts of Jesus in the New Testament are not stories about the resuscitated corpse of Jesus. If you don't believe me, read the text. In every account, Jesus has to introduce himself, prove who he is, appears as an unrecognizable spirit, isn't recognized on the road to Emmaus, and in today's text, is mistaken to be the gardener by one of his closest disciples. This, friends, is the realm of the mystical or spiritual experience. This is the realm of the gospel writers taking literary license to try and express in a compelling story the intangible experience of inspiration, the kind of inspiration that led to a movement that even today holds to the hope that a better world is possible. Clarence Jordan, the Baptist preacher, scholar, and founder of Koinonia Farm, I've mentioned frequently in the last few weeks, was also the author of the Cotton Patch Gospels paraphrase of the New Testament. Commenting on the meaning of Easter, he said, "The proof that God raised Jesus from the dead is not the empty tomb, but the full hearts of his transformed disciples. The crowning evidence that he lives is not an empty grave, but a spirit-filled fellowship, not a rolled-away stone, but a carried-away church." Look, over the last few months, Kurt Struckmeyer has helped me paint what I think is an undeniably clear picture that the core nature of Jesus' conspiracy of love was political. Yeah, he was accused of blasphemy as ardently as he was accused of sedition. But the bottom line is that he was a threat to the empire and domination systems of every stripe. Wherever people were being oppressed, enslaved, or denied their basic human dignity, Jesus' teachings and actions threatened the status quo with uncompromising compassion and love. If you still don't think Jesus' message was a political threat, how do you explain that most of the key leaders of the early movement faced capital punishment? According to tradition, Peter was crucified in Rome and Paul was beheaded by the Emperor Nero. The Jewish historian Josephus reports that Jesus' brother James was stoned to death by temple authorities in Jerusalem, and legends report that other disciples met similar fates. Andrew and Bartholomew crucified, Stephen stoned to death, and James, the son of Zebedee, beheaded. Something was going on in the early Jesus movement that clearly threatened authorities. But by the 4th century, when Christianity was absorbed by Rome, the conspiratorial gospel of Jesus had already begun to be superseded by the gospel about Jesus. And for nearly 2,000 years, church and empire had become nearly indistinguishable. Many folks don't want the whole story or don't have the time to be bothered. Let's just skip to the happy ending, thank you very much. We don't really want Good Friday and death or multiple conflicting versions of the story. And in fact, we're not really that attracted to Jesus' words about loving enemies or returning good for evil either. And to be honest, it's hard to work up any genuine concern for people who are marginalized by poverty or illness or immigration status or any number of other social realities. Wow. So on this Easter Sunday, where does that leave us? Well, what happens to Mary on her Easter Sunday? Jesus says, "Don't cling to me," and immediately gives Mary a hands-on mission. Go back to the disciples, get those lunkheads to unlock the door, and try to talk some sense into them, which she does. In other words, Jesus says, get busy. Sorry things didn't work out the way you planned, you know, conquering the Romans and being nominated to choice cabinet positions in Jesus' new administration. Looks like you're going to actually have to figure out how to do what Jesus taught. Help somebody who's hurting. Open eyes of love for someone who is blind. Free a captive. Heal a wound. Feed someone who is hungry. Give the gift of yourself. For the gift of who we are was given to us in order to be given away. Truly living is giving who we are and what we have completely, wholly away to something greater than ourselves. Jesus did it with such passion that his life, death, and the inspiration he generated became more than anyone around him could even comprehend. So Don't settle for Easter being some secondhand event experienced by someone else for your benefit. Get in there and make Easter firsthand. As Clarence Jordan said, get carried away. Remember, when people who believe in Jesus' message of hope and justice follow his example in the world, Jesus is alive and well. Those who are getting in there and doing the often thankless, dangerous, and sometimes scandalous work of Jesus' conspiracy of love are the ones who experience Easter firsthand. It ceases to be some fantastical story we read about having happened thousands of years ago and becomes a reality in the here and now. United Methodist Bishop Leontine Kelly was the first Black woman bishop in the history of the Christian Church. While her father, brother, and husband were all Methodist ministers and she was eminently qualified, she faced a lot of challenges, including being rejected as a candidate for bishop by her own southeastern jurisdiction. But only 24 hours later, after being invited to fly cross-country to become a candidate in the West, Bishop Kelly was elected bishop right here in our own Western jurisdiction. When Bishop Kelly was a little girl, her father was appointed to serve a formerly all-white Methodist church in Cincinnati, Ohio. She said that it was the most magnificent church she had ever seen. Its architecture was Gothic. It had beautiful polished wood and a crystal chandelier. It was a church with a great history. Presidents had worshiped there. A president had even been married in that sanctuary. The parsonage was so huge that every child could have their own room. The church, the education building, and the parsonage occupied an entire city block. Bishop Kelly said that there was a huge cellar under the parsonage. She was afraid to go down there because it was such a dark, dingy place with only a couple of dim light bulbs that hanging from wires amidst cobwebs and shadows. One day, her brothers called her to the cellar. They'd found a hole next to the furnace leading to a tunnel and thought that Leontine was small enough to maybe crawl through and explore it. She refused, and they tried to force her. She caused such a commotion that their father came down to investigate. When he saw the hole, he knew they'd found something special. Once they began excavating a little, they found a brick-lined tunnel that connected the parsonage to the church. That evening at supper in the parsonage, Leontine Kelly's father said, "Children, I want you to remember this day as long as you live. For today, in this church and in this parsonage, we have found a station on the Underground Railroad." She learned that the Underground Railroad didn't have tracks, and it wasn't all underground, but that it was a secret network set up to help slaves escape to freedom. She learned that a station like their house was a place where slaves could rest, get food and care, and receive the kind of support and encouragement that would contribute toward lifting them out of the pits of slavery and despair. Leontine also learned that it was against the law to help slaves, and that the railroad was run at great risk to all. You might even say it was like a conspiracy set on undermining the status quo that most Christians had either become comfortable with or who were too afraid and uncertain to do anything about. Leontine Kelly's father said, "You know what? The greatness of this church is not in its Gothic architecture, or in its beautiful wood, in its crystal chandelier, or its social status. The greatness of this church is down in the cellar. We are on hallowed ground." He said these people were not content to be a successful white church. They dared to take a risk to become involved, caring for and helping poor, frightened, runaway slaves make good their escape. Kelly said that she'll always remember that after the revelation that their church had a history of resurrecting slaves from living death to new life, the next Sunday was better than Easter. And that's what Easter firsthand is all about. To take the spirit of the story, a story the details of which no one knows, and running with it in your life, here and now. Leontine Kelly went down into that cellar scared to death, but came out of it inspired to change the world. Mary started out confused and grief-stricken, but having heard her name called by Jesus, she left rejoicing, knowing that whatever happened going forward, new life was always possible. May each of us embrace this Easter day, dissatisfied with leaving Easter as some secondhand story, and committed to engage in changing the world, in putting love first, firsthand. Be well, and happy Easter.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.wepuTLoveFirst.org.